Hello there, and welcome back to another episode of Story Secrets. I'm your host, Father Roderick, and today I'm going to do a deep dive into the themes and the deeper layers of part two of the Obi-Wan Kenobi television series. We'll be talking about the overall story, about the character development, and about a certain number of, I think, very interesting themes, the basic ingredients of a good story, and of a good Star Wars story in particular.
You didn't know. He's alive, Obi-Wan. Anakin Skywalker is alive.
I watched this second episode in Anaheim when I was at the Star Wars celebration a couple of months ago, and it was an unforgettable experience. We had been at one of the big panels in the morning, and at the end of that panel, Ewan McGregor, who plays Obi-Wan Kenobi, told us that that same evening we would get to see the world premiere of the first two episodes of the Obi-Wan Kenobi television series in the presence of the entire cast and a lot of other people that had been working on the show. And I think it was for us as Star Wars fans, but also for them as people who had worked so long on this series, an unforgettable experience. And I remember that especially the last few frames of the episode, showing us, of course, for the first time, a glimpse of Anakin, Darth Vader now, got us all on our feet, and it was a perfect conclusion of that two-episode story arc that is so important to establish where we are in the life of Obi-Wan Kenobi. It puts all the players in place. It tells you the beginning of the quest, what's at stake, and from there we get that the final kind of stake that is shown us is Vader and Vader's presence and what that means to Obi-Wan Kenobi, who had not been aware of the fact that his former friend and pupil was still alive. So I have very fond memories of those first two episodes, and it was great to rewatch the show, and I was picking up on way more details than I did the first few times that I saw these episodes. So let's begin by reading the episode summary that we find on Wikipedia. After tracking Leia's kidnappers to the planet Dayu, Kenobi encounters con man Haja Estree, who pretends to be a Jedi. Haja directs Kenobi to Leia's location, where he defeats the kidnappers and rescues her. The Grand Inquisitor learns of their presence and puts the city on lockdown. Reva disobeys orders and places a new bounty on Kenobi, causing mercenaries around the city to target him and Leia. When Leia realizes that they are after Kenobi, she loses trust in him and runs away. Escaping to a roof with mercenaries attempting to kill them, Leia jumps off and Kenobi saves her using the Force, gaining back her trust. Haja finds and directs them to an unguarded cargo port from which they can escape, but he cannot stop Reva from following them. And Reva reveals to Kenobi that Anakin, whom Kenobi believed to be dead, is still alive as Darth Vader. The Grand Inquisitor then arrives to arrest Kenobi himself, but Reva stabs him with her lightsaber, inadvertently allowing Kenobi and Leia to escape. And elsewhere, Vader awakens in a Bacta tank. The end. Amazing, amazing episode. I do have a few minor points of criticism, and let's start with a general evaluation of what the episode, how it looked, how it was executed. And first of all, I was very happy that right from the start of this episode, we go to a different planet. This is something that I hoped they would do with this series, instead of being stuck on Tatooine in a certain way, where we have already spent so much time with Boba Fett and all his people. We were going off planet on this quest to find Leia, who had been abducted in the last moments of the previous episode. And so we see this new planet, this classic shot of a spaceship entering the atmosphere, going through the clouds, and then we are shown this kind of sprawling city at night that very much evokes Hong Kong, an Asian city. There are lots and lots of neon signs, and it's also kind of gritty. It also reminds me of a bit of the underworld of Coruscant that we saw in the prequels, even though you can tell that this was done with a very limited budget. Although, well, what is a limited budget nowadays? But definitely with more modest means, because the place looks a bit empty. I loved how they played with light and how it was very atmospheric, but in a lot of these overhead shots, you still notice that there are only a few extras here and there, and you kind of miss the crowds that you would associate with a big city like that. And of course, it's because this was all filmed in a digital environment, with only a few extras being able to be present on set because of the COVID regulations at the time, and also just the restrictions of that particular set. And so that would be my only visual problem that I had with this episode, that everything that takes place on this planet, on Dayu, doesn't match what we've seen on Coruscant. And it is only because we've been so spoiled with the amazing depiction of Coruscant in the prequels that you kind of expect to see something similar here. And, well, it wasn't there. But that's about it. I think they were otherwise very creative in using the set technology and also CGI to still create a compelling visual narrative with lots of different locations, even on the planet itself. They go on rooftops, they go into small corridors and alleys. I think they did a pretty good job still making it visually very interesting. If you've seen the fan cut or the fan edit that was made, there was this guy who took all the episodes and cut out a lot of the what in his eyes was fluff and condensed it into one, like a 2-hour movie or something like that. I think that it really works well, in particular, the scenes that take place here on Dayu. It's because of the pacing. It's much faster paced. You don't notice the emptiness of the place. And I think it really makes it even more exciting than it already was. And then, of course, you also have the first kind of major leading role, I should say, of Reva, who is really in charge here and starts to become a very prominent character for the evolution of the story. It's because of her that Kenobi discovers that Anakin is alive, and because he knows that, everything changes. So she's a very pivotal character in this episode. And of course, the episode also continues to develop Leia and shows us how much this young Leia is already the Princess Leia that we get to meet in A New Hope and in the subsequent movies. The gist of her character is already here. Very, very good writing. Excellent acting. So, in the previous episode, the kind of the setup, you should say, we were introduced to the hero's journey of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Now, the hero's journey, of course, is this kind of overall framework that a lot of stories and myths that we like are following, either consciously or subconsciously. And Campbell wrote multiple articles about this. Some of them were bundled in a book. And we know that George Lucas was a huge fan of Campbell and that theory of how storytelling ultimately always comes back to these same themes. And so the hero's journey always begins with a status quo, like the familiar world. And this, for our main character, for Obi-Wan, is, of course, Tatooine. And it is very familiar to him because every day is the same. It's the same ritual. He goes to the meat factory or whatever it's called. He works there all day, doesn't really speak to people, slices up a bit of meat for his the riding animal that he has at home. Then he goes to his cave, and that's where he sits and feels miserable and tries to reach Qui-Gon Jinn, his master, but you really get the sense that he is super isolated. It's the dark night of the soul. And then every once in a while he will walk up to the homestead and observe Luke and Owen and Beru, and will make sure that Luke is safe, because after all that is his mission, and he feels that his previous life is over. This is now the only thing that gives direction to his life. And so it's kind of this situation where, in a way, everything is in place, but at the same time, the story is stuck. It doesn't move. And you need this call to action, this person that introduces himself to Obi-Wan's life to set things in motion. It is a stage in the first episode that you can best describe as atonement. Obi-Wan is shown struggling with his failures, the failure to save Anakin, his failure to save the galaxy in a certain way, his failure to realize the dreams and ideals that he was called to fight for as a Jedi. He's left all of that behind, and there's almost nothing left. And this is the phase during which he will have to come to terms to that. He'll have to somehow process this and find new meaning in his life. And the thing is, this loneliness that is shown visually many times in this first episode, where you see him in this cave and you see him all alone in the desert. In a way, he's also very isolated at his day job. That is part of that stage. You are alone. All your allies and even your enemies from the past are all gone now. It's just you, in a certain way, fighting yourself, trying to overcome the hurdles, the demons in yourself. And the first moments of this second part also emphasize this loneliness, this isolation of Obi-Wan. So he arrives on the planet, and the first person he talks to is just this guy who works at the local airport or spaceport, and just asks him how things work on that on Dayu. And then the answer that he gets is, well, you know what? All communications are blocked here. People like their secrets. So again, there's no communication with any of his allies. There's no way for him to reach other people. It's mirroring his mental state, where he is all alone and he can't seem to communicate with the outside world. He can't even seem to communicate with his former master, Qui-Gon Jinn. All communications are blocked. It's also dark. It's night at the city of Dayu, and the only light there is artificial. It's just the light coming from many neon signs. Another, I think, symbolic way to show that the inner light of Obi-Wan Kenobi is no longer there. It's dark, and he doesn't really know where to search, where to look. And he's been stuck, basically, in this phase of atonement for about a decade now. And in this struggle of finding new purpose, you need someone to wake you up. And in the first episode, that is Bail Organa, who is kind of like a mentor figure in the hero's journey, a teacher. Comparable to Yoda in The Empire Strikes Back, or even Obi-Wan himself in A New Hope. And that is like a wise man who will convince you that you have to leave the status quo, that you have to start searching, that someone who encouraged you to go on that journey of the hero. And so Obi-Wan has listened to this teacher, to Bail Organa. He is on his way. But now the next phase is, how can he, after all this isolation, in all this solitude, how can he find new allies? And this is part of a test phase. This is the phase where the hero needs to learn again, after this time of isolation, who he can trust. He gets to meet potential allies. But the question is, of course, are they trustworthy? And it's interesting that we get introduced very briefly to a couple of persons. The first one is, of course, a cameo by Temuera, who plays a homeless clone warrior. And you see that Obi-Wan recognizes the face, of course, because he's been around these clones for years and years and years. But of course, it's not the other way around. The clone warrior may have never met Obi-Wan Kenobi, certainly must have heard of him, but hasn't met him in person. And of course, Obi-Wan looks different. He's just a bearded guy, and you know, it doesn't really occur to him that it could be Obi-Wan Kenobi. He just asks for some money, and that's what he gets. So that's the first, let's say, story-wise, this is another moment where Obi-Wan realizes that this was an ally in the past, but he can no longer count on the clone warriors. They're no longer there. That's over. He needs to find new allies. And then there's this girl that walks up to him and asks him, "Hey, old man, do you want to have some spice or, you know, drugs, basically?" And then Obi-Wan is, and it's very funny that the actress who plays her is actually in real life Ewan McGregor's daughter, who auditioned for the role. So it wasn't like a favor that they did to her. She had to audition and she got the role. And it's very interesting to see that father and daughter are playing opposite of each other. And of course, this girl offers another solution in the form of, "Let me help you forget. Here's a freebie. Basically a gateway drug, and then we'll go from there." But of course, that is also not a solution. It's going to just keep him imprisoned in the past. And so that's not the way forward too. So he has to step away from her as well. And then there's this boy. And this boy kind of knows that he's looking for someone and tells him, "Hey, I can bring you to a Jedi. And maybe this Jedi can help you. You just have to pay a price." And that is interesting to Obi-Wan. He's like, "Huh, a Jedi right here? I might as well just check it out and see who this Jedi is." And so, of course, he doesn't divulge that he himself was once a Jedi. He's like, "Well, I thought all the Jedi were gone." But the boy brings him to this Jedi who is sitting in a room where he's helping a mother and her son to escape from the planet and go to Corellia. Very interesting little detail is that this may actually be a nod to, I think, some of the novels where this may refer to characters that have already been established, that we don't get names or anything, but it could be interesting that maybe later we will go to Corellia if they ever do a second season, or maybe in another part of the story that they will develop later on, maybe in the novels we will get to learn more about this mother and her child. But I wouldn't be surprised if this was a deliberate nod to the hardcore Star Wars fans who are like, "Huh, could that be so-and-so?" And just keep us guessing. Anyway, Obi-Wan observes the transaction, because that's what it is. This so-called Jedi wants to have money, and he pretends to to use mind control of this helper somewhere near the docking bay, but it all turns out to be a scam. And so after the mother and the child are gone, he confronts Haja and tells him it's all trickery. You're a fake Jedi. It's like a false shepherd in the gospel, you know? You look like a shepherd, but you're not. You're just in it for yourself. You're just in it for the money. And then it gets really interesting. Because then Haja asks Obi-Wan, who are you? And that is a pivotal question also on the meta level of the story, of the character development of Obi-Wan. Who are you? Who are you now? Are you a bounty hunter? Haja wants to know. And Obi-Wan doesn't really answer. He doesn't say, I'm a Jedi. He just defines himself by his mission. So I have to find this girl. And I want you to help me. And that's interesting as well. So this is still at the stage where Obi-Wan, having lost himself in a certain way, can only define himself by his job, just like he did for the past decade when he was on Tatooine. And his job was just to be the protector of Luke and to make sure that he's safe with Owen and Beru. And so here too, his definition of, or his answer to the question, who are you, is I just need to find this girl. But then, of course, what is interesting here is the question, who is a Jedi more here in this situation? Is it the fake Jedi who uses tricks, parlor tricks, basically, to scam people out of money, but still helps that mother and that child? Or is it Obi-Wan Kenobi, who actually deserted his vocation as a Jedi, who has shut himself off of the Force, doesn't even try to use the Force, refuses to act like a Jedi? Who is the Jedi right here? It's an interesting confrontation. And maybe Obi-Wan, by encountering Haja, also looks into a mirror. Like, this is not a Jedi, but who am I? Am I that Jedi? And I think that this confrontation is done deliberately as a setup for what follows later on the rooftops. So let's go there. The next phase of this test of faith that is part of the hero's journey at this time is to find out who your allies are and your traitors. So far, Obi-Wan has only met people that are not going to be his allies. And then he finally gets to meet Leia. And it's a classic scene of the rescue of the princess, of course, obviously mirroring or kind of prefiguring the rescue of Princess Leia on the Death Star by Luke Skywalker. And her reaction here also evokes what we already know from her reaction in A New Hope when she is liberated by Luke and Han. Like, where's the army? Aren't you a little small for a stormtrooper? Some kind of rescue this is. And so she is immediately kind of testing the reality of this rescue. And if necessary, she will take charge. And she does so. The first time that Obi-Wan enters her holding cell, she attacks him. And so, again, showing that fearless character of Leia that will be so important later on in her life. But this is also, for Obi-Wan, the moment that he will encounter his true ally. His ally right now is not the Force, even though that is what he would teach later on to Luke. It's what Yoda has taught him. But since he hasn't got the Force as an ally, his true ally and the one who actually awakens the light in his heart is Leia, as young as she is. She can count on him, and he can count on her, but we're not there yet. What we first need to do is to establish trust. And at first, Leia doesn't really trust this guy. She doesn't know who it is. And if he is coming to help her, why is he alone? It doesn't really make sense. Why is there no army? Why doesn't he have, you know, why did he just come here in his brown, you know, monk's robes? It doesn't make sense. Maybe they could have inserted a line like, aren't you a little bit too kind of run of the mill to be a Jedi or something? They could have played with that, but they didn't. So what also happens is that Leia here meets her mentor, because this is also the story of the hero's journey of Leia. She too has left the status quo, the beautiful, peaceful surroundings of Alderaan, and she is not really called to adventure, but basically just abducted into the adventure. But she too will have to learn how to survive on this journey, and the mentor, the teacher, is for her Obi-Wan Kenobi. Then the Grand Inquisitor decides to lock down the entire planet. He now knows that that Leia is being helped by this other guy. I'm not sure if he has all the details yet, but Reva absolutely knows what's going on, and her trick luring Obi-Wan Kenobi to the planet by abducting Leia has worked. Of course, she has foreknowledge. She knows much more about the whole situation than the Grand Inquisitor. And so, but the Grand Inquisitor locks down the entire planet, and this is an important moment story-wise. This is where, at the beginning of the journey of the hero, there is this gatekeeper, or the threshold guardian. And in this case, it's the Grand Inquisitor. That's the first threshold guardian. It's basically the one who, as soon as the hero gets going, locks down everything, blocks the way. And it's the first obstacle to overcome. If you think back of the first prequel movie, The Phantom Menace, there is this moment where young Anakin is called to adventure. These two Jedi visit him and ask his mother, Shmi, can we take this boy with us, because we believe that he's destined for great things. And then the moment they want to leave Tatooine, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's this Darth Maul that at least Anakin has never met. And Darth Maul attacks them, and there's this lightsaber fight between Qui-Gon and Darth Maul. And in that instance, Darth Maul is the first threshold guardian, and they defeat him and they get off the planet. And then later on, of course, there will be another confrontation with this threshold guardian, just as in this series, there will be an ulterior confrontation with, the Grand Inquisitor, with Reva. But of course, the biggest threshold guardian of all is going to be Vader. But we're not there yet. So as soon as Leia learns that Reva has put a price on Obi-Wan's head, she loses trust. She's like, this guy is they're searching for him. He's wanted. He's been telling lies. He's not here to save me. He's going to use me as leverage or whatever. And she runs away. And this is the second episode that she runs away. We've all also seen that same behavior in the first episode. It wasn't a very well executed scene. It was a little bit unbelievable that a young girl could outrun so many villains. But it's a story. It's a fairy tale. It doesn't matter. Here too, she's running away from Obi-Wan, who tries to go after her, but also, of course, her former abductors, and then, of course, there's the Inquisitors that are trying to get hold of her. She then climbs on the roof, and there's this very perilous situation that ends in her jumping off the roof. Now, whenever someone jumps over a chasm, jumps into the depths or whatever, plunges into the water, steps out of the boat, those are all moments that symbolize the leap of faith. Think of Peter, the Apostle Peter, who is in the boat, and then in the middle of a storm, he sees this vague figure walking over the waters towards him, and then they recognize that it's Jesus, who tells him to step out of the boat and to come towards Jesus. And That's what he does. He steps out of the boat. It's this test of faith. It's this leap of faith. And of course, his faith is not strong enough yet. And so Jesus stretches out his hand and catches him before he's swallowed by the waters. And this is a very, very similar scene, same function. Leah steps off the roof, plunges to her death, unless the Savior, Obi-Wan Kenobi, reaches out and grabs her. And if he can't reach out with his hand, physically he can't grab her. But that's the moment that he realizes he has to reach out with the Force. He can't do it by himself. He needs the Force to save this little girl. And that's the moment that he opens his heart to the Force again. Just like St. Peter, when he is almost swallowed up by the waters, yells out, "Lord, save me." And that's the same prayer. It's the same opening. And then, of course, if you pray, that prayer is going to be answered. And so Jesus pulls him out of the water, brings him to safety. And here, Obi-Wan Kenobi, as soon as he feels the flow of the Force, is able to stop Leia from falling to her death right at that very moment. It's a very strong, strong sequence in this episode. I really love the execution in the aforementioned fan edit. They make it even stronger by playing the Force theme, and it's got a lot of like very, very strong orchestral music. That was really giving me goosebumps. It was so cool. And this, is a breakthrough moment in the journey of our hero. Not only is he working on establishing trust between him and Leia, but he is reestablishing his trust with his former ally, the Force itself. And then we get to another stage. Once he has saved Leia and opened up to the Force, that's basically the end of that part of his journey. And so the story has to move to a new phase. You cannot do like another chase, or that would just be repetition. And so instead, we get this confrontation between him and the third sister, Reva. And while Reva is still looking for Obi-Wan and Leia, she tells him that Anakin did not just fall to the dark side and then die, but that he is alive and is now the galaxy's second greatest villain. Well, she doesn't really give away that there's this emperor, but and this is news to Obi-Wan. This is part of the enlightenment phase, the moment where the hero receives greater knowledge that will inform his next decisions. And so obviously for Obi-Wan, this is traumatizing. This greater knowledge, this enlightenment, doesn't immediately lead to salvation and to freedom. It leads to trauma, because now he realizes that Anakin survived the battle. And so he has felt guilty, of course, of having to, you know, be at least the instrumental cause of the death of Anakin. But now he has to struggle with the fact that he wasn't even aware that Anakin survived. He closed himself off of the Force, so he probably couldn't even sense what happened to Anakin. Just as Luke, in his isolation in The Force Awakens and in The Last Jedi, because he was closed off the Force, also had no idea what was going on in the rest of the galaxy and what happened to his friends. And so now that he has access to the Force again, and he has this extra knowledge of Anakin being alive, that all kind of hits him like a ton of bricks. It's almost as if Reva stabs him in the heart, metaphorically. It's like she knows that this is devastating news to Obi-Wan, because what is worse, losing a friend because death, or losing a friend to the dark side? He's alive, and yet everything that was good in this person has died. That second death is much worse than the first death. And so Reva kind of punishes and tortures Obi-Wan with that knowledge, hoping, of course, that would incite him to step forward and to, you know, maybe even get enraged. It felt a bit like the confrontation at the end of the Return of the Jedi, where Darth Vader, when he's looking for Luke, and the Emperor is sitting there up on his throne, and Luke is hiding in the shadows, Darth Vader says, a sister. Well, if you don't turn, maybe she will turn to the dark side. And then Luke is unable to control himself, and he steps out, and that's exactly, of course, why Vader said that. And here, I think Reva is trying the same technique. Just by stabbing the heart of Obi-Wan, she hopes that he will step forward. But instead, guess who arrives on the scene? It is the Threshold Guardian, the Grand Inquisitor. And he is now not just a Threshold Guardian for Obi-Wan, but he's also the Threshold Guardian for Reva. Because, of course, Reva as a main character also follows the hero's journey. So she, too, is on this quest of coming to terms with herself, with her past, with everything that was wrong, her inability to save the other Padawans during Order 66, her hatred, all that, her darkness in her own soul. She, too, is in a phase of atonement. And she is now on the verge of taking the next step into her journey. And according to her plan, it would be capturing Obi-Wan, getting brought to Vader, and then killing Vader. That's her plan. But here's this Threshold Guardian who blocks her way, who blocks her ambition. And so there's only one way, and this has surprised a lot of people, but there is only one way. If you follow the logic of the hero's journey, there's only one thing that could happen, and that is that she kills the Threshold Guardian. She has to overcome the Grand Inquisitor so her story can move forward. And that's what she does, thereby also unlocking the future for Leia and Obi-Wan. So it's very funny that this one Threshold Guardian is defeated by Reva, and that opens the rest of the journey for Reva herself, for Obi-Wan, and for Leia. And this is then followed by the moment of the resurrection. So now that apparently the Grand Inquisitor is dead, we get a hint that death may not be as permanent as we think, because we see Vader, Anakin, awakening in the Bacta tank. He, who was thought to be dead, was not truly dead. Maybe already setting the scene for the reawakening, the resurrection of the Grand Inquisitor later on. A lot of people were like, yeah, why is he killed right now? I mean, he's a great villain. That seemed illogical. And then his return at the end of the series was also criticized by many people. Like, come on, how could he have survived that? Well, it turns out there actually the guy has two hearts or something like that. So there is an in-world explanation why he survived this attack. But story-wise, it was also important for this Grand Inquisitor to return and to face the Reva, that main character again. This time, kind of turning things upside down. Now she is the one, and this will happen later on, so we'll talk about that when we're there. She's the one who gets almost killed by the Grand Inquisitor. But now that we see Vader opening his eyes in the Bacta tank, this is the moment that Obi-Wan is pulled back in his past and now will have to confront his greatest fear. He has to look Anakin in the eye, which is not possible because Anakin wears a mask, but that is solved in a certain way. But they come face to face, literally. And that, of course, is the only way forward. He has to face his greatest fear. It's part of this journey of atonement. So there you go. That is, in a nutshell, why the second episode is a pivotal moment in the story and leads into the further development of the second act. Now, I want to wrap things up by giving you some personal thoughts. And I think that a lot of these themes resonate with all of us. We are, in a certain way, all on a hero's journey. I sometimes think that we forget that we are telling the story of our lives ourselves. We sometimes think that our life is only determined by external factors, by what people do to us, by the chances that we get, or the opportunities, or by also the bad luck and fate and whatnot. But we tell the story of our lives. And so our story, our personal life story, also has these moments of the hero's journey. We also are not just in this status quo. We have received a calling and at various moments in our lives. And maybe there are still going to be moments where we feel this vocation, this calling to change, to go on a journey, to step outside of our comfort zone, to leave the familiar world behind. And in our lives, there also will be this reluctance to say yes to that. I've had many moments in my life where things were changing, something happened, and I resisted it. I was like, no, this is not how I plan things. People can't do that to me. And I kind of put myself in the isolation of a victim. Like, why is this done to me? And then the whole journey of your life consists in discovering that you are the one who has to move forward. And hopefully you will encounter a tutor, a mentor that will help you on your way. I remember that in the first few years that I was working as a priest, I got a burnout, a very severe burnout. And I felt that was so unjust. I was doing so much. I was trying to work as hard as I could. I wanted to be a good priest. And then nobody seemed to be content with that. They always wanted more. And I kept telling myself that I needed to do more and more. And so I got a burnout. And thankfully, in the recovery process after the burnout, I had a very good mentor who actually told me to embrace the failure in a certain way, to acknowledge it, to no longer look at your life from the perspective of a victim, but from the perspective of someone who is able to change and who is able to learn from the things that went wrong. And it was all about realizing that the world didn't depend on me. I was not the savior. And as a priest, that's true. That's really ontologically true. I am an instrument, but I'm not Jesus. So I'm not saving, he is. And letting go of that self-imposed duty, a bit like Obi-Wan, who tells himself, I cannot leave Tatooine because it's my duty to take care of Luke. And then you've got this mentor figure, Bail Organa, who tells him, hey, but I need your help right now. What about my daughter? I need you to go on this journey. Well, in a similar way in my own life, this mentor told me, well, now it's up to you to make new choices and to learn from your mistakes and embrace also the fact that you are not Jesus, that you are fallible, that you have your weaknesses. And it's only when you recognize that and you embrace it that you can open up to other people that can help you. And so along the way, and that was not a fun process. I felt very, very lonely during that time. But the moment I started to open up to the possibility that this failure may have been just a threshold guardian moment where I thought that my life was stuck in a certain way because people were blocking the way. Once I got over that, I started to meet new people. I started to open up and I got allies and not just enemies, as I imagined that everybody was my enemy because that nobody was happy with me as a priest. And then I discovered, no, that's just in my mind. I have to change. And if I change, my perception will change. Your focus determines your reality, Qui-Gon Jinn teaches Anakin. And that's true. The moment I changed my perception and I started to look differently at myself, at my life, at the people around me, the future started to open up. And then this is absolutely a test. It's not easy. It requires courage and faith. And it takes time to reestablish that trust. Heck, I even had to reestablish my trust with God because I felt that if I failed as a priest in a certain way, I was blaming God. Why did you put me in this parish? Why did you let me get overworked? Why did you allow this burnout to happen? And then, of course, I didn't get an answer. I prayed in those months that I was overworked, very much like Obi-Wan is calling on Qui-Gon Jinn. He's like, where are you? I need you right now. Now is when I need you the most, and you're not there. And that's exactly how I felt in my life as well. And it is only later on that I discovered that God was not blocking the communication. I was blocking it. And when I opened up, that's when the conversation with God started again, and we reestablished the trust. Or, well, God has always trusted me, but I needed to learn again to trust God. And that ultimately, for me, that led to a lot of new knowledge. So the enlightenment was literally shedding light on the situation and learning that this was just part of the story. It's part of the journey. Every defeat, every moment of failure is not a dead end. It's always the beginning of something new, provided that you open yourself to what this situation can teach you. If you open yourself up to the help of others, the guidance of, well, not the Force maybe, but definitely the Holy Spirit, that has helped me to understand, to get a better understanding of who I am and what I'm supposed to do. And then ultimately there is this rebirth, this kind of resurrection. And this is not just one time in my life and then everything is A-okay. No, I've gone through these moments of crisis multiple times. But there's always, if you continue the journey, there will be this moment of rebirth, of resurrection, where you wake up and you're like, oh, now I think I can start anew. And in fact, it's not just a reboot. I've learned from this. I'm stronger now. I have a clearer vision of who I am and where I'm going. And so this is what makes life so compelling and so rich. It's that no matter what happens, if you keep looking at your own life as a journey, if you keep looking at yourself as maybe not a hero per se, but in God's eyes, we are definitely his hero. He wants us to succeed. He wants us to do great things, but he also wants us to first learn that we cannot do that without acknowledging how weak we are and that we need this force to live in us so that he can be great in us. That, anyway, that's a very religious interpretation of this story, but it definitely resonated in me. And I'm very curious to hear your reaction. So let me know in the comments on Patreon, on Discord, or on social media if this episode, and maybe also thanks to these extra explanations or the my comments here, if that resonates with you personally as well. I love it when Star Wars does that, when it's not just a fairy tale, but when it's also about us in a certain way. Maybe that is why I love Star Wars so much. It's because I always feel that the stories in Star Wars are ultimately also my story. And even though I've never had a role, I was never an extra in Star Wars, and maybe that will never happen, but I think I'm still part of Star Wars. I'm part of that story. I am going through the same things as the characters that I love so much in this great franchise. Anyway, that's what I wanted to share with you. Thank you so much for listening. And I can only say, see you next time when we talk about episode 3. And in the meantime, may the Force be with you. Take care.